In this episode of Real Nurse Stories, I interview Jackie, who's a director of nursing over in Queensland in Australia. Jackie is a wonderful storyteller, and her career journey is fascinating. And it's probably one of those rare occasions as an interviewer of nurses for my podcast where you could just sit and listen as the story unfolds without really very much prompting or having to ask questions. Jackie's story is just littered with so many takeaways around how she's seized opportunities in her career, how she's passionate about making a difference. She's definitely a lifelong learner and very much a people leader. And she shares lots of helpful takeaways and things that she's learned from the breadth and depth of her knowledge and wisdom in nursing that really has been gained from all the different opportunities that she's really sometimes taken a leap of faith and gone with it and grown and learnt as a result. Sometimes also people save the best till last, and Jackie's fascinating answer to how she would like to be most remembered, I think, was something of a surprise for me at the end of this interview. And I'm not going to tell you what that is, but have a listen, because this is just such a fabulous interview. And yeah, it left me feeling very positive, full of energy, really kind of enthused about just everything that Jackie shared with me today. So I hope you enjoy this episode. I would love to hear your feedback. Take a listen. Hi, and welcome to Real Nurse Stories. Today on the show, I'm interviewing Jackie. Jackie is a nursing midwifery director who's working in Southeast Queensland. Hi, Jackie, and welcome to Real Nurse Stories.
Hi, Eva. Thank you. And it's a great pleasure to be doing this with you today.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to have you here as well. I'm really thrilled to be able to talk to you about your career history. So if we can perhaps just start right at the beginning, Jackie, and if you wouldn't mind just sharing a little bit with me about what made you decide to become a nurse in the first instance.
Yeah, oh, that takes you back, doesn't it, when you go back to the beginning. I don't know when it the idea of actually wanting to be a midwife was really my passion, and I don't know when that just suddenly popped into my head. But I remember that my grandma was a nurse at the time, and she wasn't very well, and I, you know, I always wondered whether she'd actually see me qualify as a nurse, and you know, I wonder and think, oh, she'd be so proud. And that eventuated that she actually didn't see me qualify as a nurse, but that's okay. I had a friend whose mum was a nurse as well, and I found myself, you know, listening to them and talking to them, and that really inspired me. And then they talked about, one of them was a nurse and must have been in a neonatal unit, it must have been, but she talked about working with children and babies, and I really decided that was probably more me. Mm. And then I started to do a bit of research, like you do, a bit of reading up, what's a midwife, and hearing all the stories that people tell you about, oh, when they had children, that sort of brings out all those stories, which is always fabulous to hear. And then my mum, you know, my mum had talked to me about a maternity home in the UK. I was born in Bramley Mead in Clitheroe in Lancashire in the UK, and it was a maternity home, and it was this beautiful Victorian house, and she talked about how it happened, and I think that was probably the light bulb moment that I thought, ooh, no, that's the job I want. That's the job I want. What a privilege, what an honour to be in one of the most private experiences in your life.
Yeah.
You know, the birth of a baby, the birth of that couple's child. But I remember thinking that, you know, that my mum said that my dad, you know, fathers weren't allowed in the birthing room back then. And I remember thinking, well, that's not fair, and that's awful. And what about the support for the woman? And, oh, well, she's got, you know, my mum, I remember my mum saying, but I had the midwife. I had the midwife. It was like, it doesn't matter, I had the midwife, you know. And I just thought how, what a role to be in, you know, and yeah. and how valuable the women must feel that role could be to them in that instance where they didn't have anybody in the birthing room with them. And I just thought, what a privilege, what an honor. And you know, and I thought, you know, I could do that, and I could make a difference. I can really make a difference. So that's really my light bulb moment. And from then on, I wanted to be a midwife. But of course, back in those days, you couldn't just be a midwife. You can't, you know, there was no direct entry midwifery when I wanted to be a midwife. So you had to do nursing. But I have no regrets doing nursing first. I had a fabulous 3 years nursing. I had a couple of good years after that as a what they call staff nurses in England, registered nurses. I worked in women's health gynecology, and I just, it, you know, I never look back. I never look back, and I never have any regrets. And as I've gone through into midwifery, it, you know, every stepping stone, I believe, you know, was always for a reason. And it's always, I've always had lots of learnings from it, and it's always set me up for the next step that I needed to take.
Yeah.
So that's where it all began for me.
Well, that's great. So you kind of grew up really influenced by stories and listening to people talk about midwifery and babies and nursing. That was,
pretty much, yes.
When did you actually go into practice midwifery and to train as a midwife?
That would be 1992. Yeah, qualified in 1994. So, yeah, 1992.
So you did that straight after your training? You went in to train to be a midwife, or was that a little while after you qualified as a nurse?
It was quite soon after. I think we were probably about only 14 to 18 months I probably did as a staff nurse on the women's health in the gynae surgical and wards. So it wasn't long. So yeah, from qualifying and doing that and then going into midwifery, it was probably only about 18 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just knew I needed to get into midwifery. So that was me, you know, my goal.
Yeah. And how long did you work in midwifery for, Jackie?
Well, I do consider myself to still be working in midwifery, even though I'm not physically hands-on. But I've not really had a very direct career pathway in midwifery. I have sort of waffled around the edges of it, as I say. But I've always considered myself, and always re-registered every year and kept my hand in as much as I can in midwifery. So, but physically hands-on as a midwife, right up until, well, I emigrated in 2004 to Australia, and I still kept my hand in doing casual midwifery in this country for a while. And then I ended up in a child health role based on my health visitor experience in the UK. So I really haven't worked as a full-time midwife since leaving the UK, really. Mm. So what would that be? I became a health visitor in 2001. So, and I just kept my hand in doing a casual midwifery at that point. So I didn't stay in midwifery full time since 2001, I'd say, but I've always kept my hand in from then. The short answer, sorry.
That's all right. So there's clearly a passion there for midwifery still after all that time.
Yeah, look, like right at the beginning, as I said, I always knew I wanted to be a midwife. That was a very direct career choice. But interestingly enough, I've never really, I won't say I've never really had a choice after that, but I have had a choice. But my career has never taken me in the direction where I've decided that's the direction I'm going in.
Yeah.
I've kind of stumbled across opportunities, or I've been asked to do things that have led to further opportunities, which I consider myself absolutely, you know, very grateful for, because for the first time in my career, about 6 months ago, I had to make a choice about two jobs and which direction I was going to go in. And I've never really had to do that since the beginning of my career.
Yeah.
because of opportunities that have been forwarded to me, or have I been asked to do things that have led on to other things without really much effort, I would say. They've sort of just, I've had to apply for jobs and I've had to go through interviews and be successful, but that's where the choice comes in. So I've chose to do those roles at that point, and I've chose to apply for them, and I've chose to go to an interview, and I've been successful. That the way I've got there was just opportunity, really. Yeah. It's never been, this is where I'm going to go, this is the direction I'm heading in. So I've been fortunate in my career that I've gone on a bit of a, not a straight line by any stretch of the imagination, but never look back on anything, because I just think everything that I have considered, that I have done, I now consider that has set me up for this current role. But I didn't know that when I was going down the career path. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Can you tell me a little bit about some of those roles that you had, sort of generally, what kind of roles did you, or came your way as opportunities?
Yeah, happy to. So I've always, like I say, always wanted to be a midwife. That was where I was going to stay, be. I could never see myself doing anything else. And then I came to be married and have a family, and life became really difficult for me and my husband to work opposite each other all the time, and we both had shift work to do, and it just became really, really difficult. And I didn't want to give up midwifery, but there was so much more scope for me in midwifery than there was.
Can you just tell me a little bit about some of the roles that you've had, Jackie? Because you've said that you took opportunities as they came to you. Can you just share with me a little bit about those roles?
Yeah, certainly. So at the time, an opportunity came up at the time in the UK that just as I was having some struggles around family, personal family ties, with the husband working shifts and I was working shifts, and we were like passing ships in the night with children, and we didn't have family close by. And not that they could probably help us out either, because they were all full-time workers themselves with careers. We really struggled, and I really only, because of midwifery having so much scope and nursing having so much scope, there was only really flexibility in what I could do to change what I could do to try and make family life, work-life balance, I guess, much better. But it was a career for me, and I wanted it all. I wanted a family, but I wanted a career as well. So I didn't want to sort of, completely give it up or go in a different direction. And I feel that giving midwifery up would just be too heartbreaking after, a lifetime of wanting to be a midwife. So I needed to find something that still aligned me with midwifery and the philosophy of midwifery and what I was currently doing. And there was an opportunity within our health authority at the time that they were looking for people to do health visitor training. And it was going to be a paid positions. And that if you did their 12-month training, that you were guaranteed a contract with that health authority for 2 years after you did your training. And, health visiting in the UK is like child health nursing to a point over here. But I would still be able to work with a mum and her children and her baby, and from the postpartum period all the way through. But this one was continuity of care and being the coordinator of all their health care and development, and with a bit of social health as well. And it just encompassed this holistic approach, and it really, really interested me. I could still use my midwifery skills. I could develop and get more and different skills. And it was Monday to Friday, which then gave me the work-life balance. So it seemed to be an opportunity too good to pass up, because it was everything I was looking for. Yeah. It would meet all my needs, but it was professional development as well. And I could see myself in this role, being able to still be and use my midwifery skills, but develop more holistically now, and even make more of a difference in a family's life now, not just a mother and baby's life, but in a family's life. So I put in an application and I was successful, and I became a health visitor 12 months later. So still keeping my hand in midwifery, of course. And that's where I was then till I emigrated to Australia, which again was always a bit of a passion for me to travel and use my midwifery skills as a midwife traveling. But now I was doing it with a husband and a family. So eventually I wanted to, you know, came to Australia, and there was no such thing as health visitors in the same form as, the independent autonomous practitioner at that level that we have in the UK. And it wasn't the same here, but child health was something similar. So I looked for child health or midwifery as my role, and I was lucky enough to get a midwifery, part-time midwifery position. So that's where I started again working as a midwife, and I did. I ended up doing a part-time child health and part-time midwifery. So I got the best of both worlds when I first emigrated, and then which was lucky. And then from there, I was asked to go and step into the child protection liaison role, for the network. And that was because somebody who had interviewed me for the child health position knew that I'd had quite a caseload in the UK that was quite socially deprived, and there was a lot of child protection in that caseload. So I'd gained an awful lot of experience in that field, and they were needing a child protection liaison officer, and somebody said, oh, Jackie's got this kind of background experience, why don't you give her a go, type of thing. So I kind of fell upon a three-month opportunity. And I thought, of course I will. I'll give it a go. I'll use what skills I've got. It's another opportunity. So I went along for 3 months, and I ended up there for 4.5 years. I just grabbed the opportunity. It was fantastic. It was, I changed the way that that unit ran. I changed the systems that they recorded the data on. We improved how we led meetings, how we profiled cases, how we presented data. We developed a whole education program, and we created an annual report every year. We developed, myself and the team, we developed a conference date every year for the whole network, and it really evolved, and I enjoyed every minute of it. But along with that, I think towards the end came a little bit of vicarious trauma, and I think being in that field for too long doesn't do your mental health any good. And I recognised that, you know, it's not really where I thought I'd end up, and I certainly didn't expect to be there for that long. So I did start looking for other opportunities, and when I started to talk about, you know, my needs for looking again for different opportunities and what might be coming up, the midwifery team in the same hospital had they were developing a new role for the midwifery group practice for midwives, and they needed somebody to step in that had skills, leadership skills and management skills, and also that had some background in midwifery that had worked in a continuity of care model. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. So I put my hat in the ring for that, and I was successful in becoming the midwifery unit manager for that team. There were, you know, a few teams within that big team. And I also took on the antenatal clinic management role and the community midwifery role at the time, because they were, you know, playing around with splitting a lot of services under one manager and making it more equitable across several managers. So I inherited a bit of that as well, and I thoroughly enjoyed that. It was great getting back into midwifery and being really in the throes of midwifery and talking midwifery every day. Really enjoyed that. It really, you know, not that I didn't enjoy what I was doing, but I really felt I'd come alive again.
Yeah.
And so I was there for 18 months, and a restructure occurred in the HHS, and you know, last in but first out type of thing occurred. You know, naturally it was just, now we have to look at, you know, cuts and changes and restructure, and one of the, you know, there was no need for all these positions at such high level. So with the restructure, it kind of went back to what it was before they created the role. So the role then, you know, some of the what I had under me in my role got disseminated back under the other roles, and my role as the num. I'd only ever been temporary because it was, you know, trial to see if it was going to be successful, and then it got extended and extended. So because it wasn't a permanent position, it of course was one of the ones that, you know, was one of the roles that were made a decision that would be cut. So that was okay. I had a permanent grade 7 role within the HHS at the time, so they just had to find me some work.
Yeah.
So again, I call it serendipity, or it just was my path to walk down. At that time, we were bringing birthing back to our rural community in that HHS, and you know, they needed somebody with midwifery skills, but they also needed somebody with nursing skills, because the nurse unit manager at that little rural hospital had just stepped away for another role, and you know, it was like, well, Jackie's surplus, she's got the skills, let's do a suitability interview. If she's, you know, if she crosses, you know, what we need, if she meets what we need, then, you know, she's appointable, let's go for it. So I was asked if I would be interested in that role, and I said yes, and I interviewed for the role, and I was successful. I obviously met the criteria. And then I became the numbstroke mum of that rural hospital, being the only one, because there was only one unit manager and there was only one nursing director. But we were bringing birthing back, we were bringing surgical services back, we were looking at growing the rural hospital. So again, I thought, this is an opportunity. I've never been a part of bringing services back in line, redesign of services. Well, this is fantastic. So I was part of that in a bigger team, and enjoyed every minute of that, and thought, I can put all my skills that I've learned so far to good use down here in that in this new role. And I did, and learned more again. And then after that, we brought birthing back, we brought surgical services back, and then the director asked me if I'd be interested in and again, never imagined in a million years I'd be in the nursing midwifery director position, never even jumped onto my radar at this stage. You know, but I knew at some point that, you know, I'd need to be sat down having my PAD and talking about where I see myself in 5 years time conversation, you know. And I thought, well, I don't know where I saw myself 5 years ago, and I wouldn't have predicted where I've been in the last 5 years. Hey, I'll give that conversation a go anytime. So she asked me if I'd be interested in backfilling her role when she went on holiday, and, you know, I thought, well, I'm probably way out of my depth here, but I'll give it a go. Of course, yeah, I'm happy to. And I did. And within the 2 weeks of me being in her role, she'd applied for another role and left the district. So I found myself in that. I found myself as a nursing midwifery director for a lot longer than the 2 weeks annual leave I signed up for. And went on this huge steep learning curve. Which I did enjoy, you know, and there were moments of challenge, as there is all the time. There's moments of challenge, and I felt like I was, you know, drowning one day and skydiving the next. And by the time 15 months had passed, I'd started to feel like I could do the job with confidence, and you know, always learning and always ready to learn the next thing, or learn every day as you do. But I felt confident that I was in a position that I was more comfortable now. And of course, they wanted to advertise the job, and I thought, well, I'm going to apply for it now. But probably 6 months earlier, I probably would have said, oh no. But at 15 months in, I thought, yeah, I'm going to apply for the job. And I was successful, fortunately. And I've been in this role ever since. And I did have a 18 months out just recently. I've been back in my role now 6 months. I did 18 months out at another hospital, regional hospital over women's and children's, the rural hospital maternity, but I was my focus was to look after the other two hospital maternity sites as well. So again, very challenging, very strategic role, but thoroughly enjoyed it, and brought what skills I'd already learned to that role, as well as learn new skills along the way, which is always the way, isn't it? So that's how I've ended up on this sort of, you know, squiggly line of a career to where I am today, rather than a straight line where I've sort of, you know, always had a plan of where I'm going. And I am a very planned and organized person, so I'm very, you know, it's interesting really that I in terms of my career, I'd never really planned to be where I've got to. It's just happened.
But that's interesting, though, isn't it? Because I think there's probably quite a few nurses who could relate to that squiggly line, you know, and I think the difference is you're open to opportunities and possibilities and put your hand up and thought, you know, you said it yourself, I'll give it a go. And it's that giving it a go that often takes you to opportunities and things that you would never have even thought about. And I think that's the great thing about nursing. There are opportunities there if you want to give it a go, and that's, you know, a great philosophy to have those experiences, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, nursing and midwifery, we're so privileged in this career that there are so many, like a spider web, really. Yeah. There's so many different directions you can go in, but still staying true to the caring profession you signed up to.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's amazing. Really amazing.
Yeah. Jackie, one
of the... Not all my experiences were fantastic. You know, I think along the way I've learned how to be a better leader and a better manager, and I've certainly learned how not to be a leader and manager when I've had not so good role models myself.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's made me really focus on, you know, grow your own philosophy, partnership philosophy. You know, we are nurturing the next generation.
Yeah.
Of nurses, whereas in my day it was very much eat your young type of philosophy. You know, so I think that's enabled me to go, this is a good role model. You know, commit that to memory. This is not how we do it. This is not a good role model. So commit that to memory.
Yeah. I think that's so true. It's, you know, I read some of those articles that Tracy and Emma wrote recently on LinkedIn, and I just, you know, I could relate to those from way back in my training, but I know there's still people who sadly have those experiences. And I think, you know, there's a lot we need to do in nursing around culture and growing the next generation, you know, and supporting them. I think that's really, really important. One of the things you've mentioned, Jackie, here is about culture changes culture. Can you just tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, look, I think there's sort of the climate, sort of like, you know, your day-to-day climate, and then there's the general culture. And I think you know, for me, I've worked in good cultures and I've worked in not so good cultures. And I think a lot of that, you try and stay true to what you believe is role modeling, you know, the values of a good culture, or what will create, you know, the values of behaviours and attitudes, what will create a good culture, should I say. And you need to do that on a day-to-day basis. Which is your climate, really. So I think culture change is not quick. No. I've experienced it's not quick. It, you know, when people said to me initially, when I first stepped into quite a poor culture, our best practice survey told us it was a poor culture, and I could feel it was a poor culture. Yeah. I could sense it was a poor culture with every sense that I had. I thought, crikey, I'm one of the leaders here now. Yeah. So, you know, and you know, it's down to me. I thought it's down to me, and then I thought, well, it's not down to me. It's down to all of us. We need the philosophy of all of us. We all lead the culture. We're all responsible for the culture. But you know, the culture at the time was so poor that they believed that it was my role to change the culture. It was all on me to change the culture. And I thought, well, first I need to really change the beliefs of that before I can change it, because I can't wave a magic wand and make it all happen. So I guess you know, talking about culture in terms of, you know, the end goal, the end result, this is what do we want out of our culture, what's the vision, what's the mission of our culture, and then the steps to how we get there. Really, fundamentally, going to sit individually with people. And I know that, you know, people can't always change the blueprint of what they fundamentally believe in, but I'd like to think that we all come from the same place. We all came into nursing or healthcare for the same reason. So that's a good place to start. Why did we want to become a nurse? Why did we want to become a midwife, health professional? Why did you want to work in a hospital? You know, surely we all come from that because we want to make change. We want to care for people. And we want to, you know, we want to make people, you know, we want to work, you know, we want to work with people holistically, and their, you know, mental health, well-being, the whole package. And what does that mean to us? And what can we do to impact people's lives? Because nurses and anybody that comes into contact with people impacts people's lives.
Yeah.
So I thought that's probably a good place to start. But sometimes it, you know, with sort of just some general, you know, bad attitudes and behaviours that really weren't, you know, really, I almost had a sense that people had lost their way and that they needed that reminder of why they came into to be a nurse or healthcare, you know, to be able to bring them back to the that reason and give them a reset, like a mind reset, really. Because I think people had started to work in, you know, silos, and they were, you know, a little bit out for themselves and lost all vision, I guess. And and I thought, well, there's as a leader, there's where I can help with, you know, with helping them reset, set the vision again and give them purpose to, you know, look to what's our end goal, get them involved, like help them decide what that end goal is going to be, and remind them that, you know, evidence-based practice and all of that research actually says that if we're working together and we trust each other and we work in the partnership philosophy and we invest in each other and we have each other's backs and it's a safe space to work in, that people generally will, you know, give that extra, they will give better healthcare, and ultimately it gives our patients better outcomes. So there's lots of obviously research out that there's that. So, you know, I thought maybe that's a place to start a conversation. So, you know, HHS at the time, you know, there was the public health values and some other values, but they seemed really far away from the values of people that, you know, were on the cold face. So we had to generally talk about values that we wanted to work by. So we created for the hospital a hospital charter. So we had lots of representation from different groups. Obviously, the bulk of it was nursing because that's the bulk of the workforce. But we all worked together to create this hospital charter, what we're going to live by. These were the values that this hospital were going to live by. And we, you know, we slowly, you know, held each other to account on that. We brought it into our orientation. We brought it into doing PADs using the values. We brought it into interviews. We recruited on those values. We brought the values into meetings, you know, all of that. So we slowly that became the foundation of change for our culture down here. And within that 5-year span, 3 to 5 years, we went from a culture of blame to a culture of consolidation to a culture of success. So we did lots of different pieces of work on that, of course, but we did show that it is a 3 to 5 year plan and it's not an overnight thing. And I remember thinking at the time when somebody said to me, "Oh, you've got a poison chalice there. How are you going to manage that?" And I fundamentally didn't agree that it was my chalice to carry. That I was part of this whole thing, and I could impart my, I could play my part.
Yeah.
But I also needed to everybody else to play their part. And it was about working with the individuals to really change mindset, reset the mindset, get them talking, having the conversation, and reminding people why we were all here, to really start, you know, I suppose, refreshing or reigniting that passion for nursing. You know, and it, you know, we had ups and downs along the way. It wasn't all successful, but, you know, by a long shot, but we got there in the end. And 5 years down, it seemed a really long way. Oh my goodness, 5 years. But you know, hey, it did take us 5 years, and we got there, you know, and now the hard work's really maintaining that culture, I reckon. It's about maintaining it through change now. So we're being thrown all these different things. So, you know, we've got the electronic medical record, and we've got change in leadership happening, and, you know, at different levels. And I think sometimes culture takes a hit when that happens. And that's the hardest part. leading or maintaining that culture through a change process. And that's where I think the resilience comes in, and I think that's where investment in our people comes in. And you know, I go back to what I said before. It's a partnership philosophy for me. I might be the leader, and I might be the person that, you know, has to sign off on things or crunches the budget or has a hard conversation sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I fundamentally believe that you know, I try and do everything in partnership with people, whatever level you're at. You know, collaborative and good communication, and grow your own. I fundamentally believe in, we have to grow our own people. So, you know, I know the workforce doesn't always allow that for us to happen, but we grow our own, we invest in our own. And mental health and well-being in the workplace today more than ever before seems to really be where we need to be focusing. You know, and, you know, people don't just come to work. And you know, the old saying, when I remember when I was a lot younger, it was, you know, leave your problems at the door, come on, get your shift done, leave your problems at the door. You've got to know all about that, you know? And it's not that anymore. You know, you come to work as the whole person. You don't come to work as the half a person. You come to work as the whole person. And, you know, if you don't come to work as a whole person, you don't give the whole person in your, you know, what you're doing every day. So you know, the philosophy of you know, of looking out for people and, you know, well-being in the workplace really needs to be a focus.
How do you foster that, Jackie, in your role? You know, because that's something that I'm passionate about in terms of the work that I do, coaching nurses, and so often people come to me at the point of, you know, almost burnout because they've gone through so much. And, you know, I'm just interested because you're so passionate about it, comes across when you talk. And how do you support staff on the floor when you're in a senior role? What are the personal things that you can do in that space?
So look, I made a choice to come back to my role, having an opportunity to stay in a different role like 6 months ago. And one of the key reasons when I was, you know, sort of remunerating around decision making was because in this role, the role I have now, because it's a small rural hospital, I have the ability to be a people leader. I can get out on the floor. I can connect with every person at every level. And I'm not just this figure of a leader that sits in, you know, an executive office. And I'm not being discriminatory of anybody that sits in an executive office with layers of levels underneath them. That is just the way that the some hospitals are built, because they're tertiary or because they're, you know, regional hospitals. For me, my passion lies with leading people and growing people, nurturing people, and being able to be very connected with people. So this role for me is my dream role, I would say. So, you know, what I do is, you know, I have very, I'm a very principled person. I have very high expectations, and I like to believe that I walk the values that are fundamentally, they are now our, we're all signing up to the organisational values of iCare, but I fundamentally believe that they're my core values anyway, so they're an easy sign up for me. And I get out to the people, I get out to the staff, I talk to the staff, I talk to everybody at every level, whether, you know, they're the cleaner or they're the AIN or the doctor or the allied health person. I really, although they all have a valuable role, I don't see them in their roles, I see them as people. So if I know that, you know, anybody's struggling or needs extra support, then it's about, you know, it's about finding out, connecting with them and finding out what's going on. I try to get to know people so that I can say to them, oh, that's a great job you did there, or I really like the way that you spoke to that person. And I really get out and try and, you know, hear them, see them, and let them know what I'm hearing and seeing and value them. And if you get to know them as well, I try to get to know them on a personal level, so not to interfere, not to be nosy. But if I hear that, you know, the daughter's having a baby or somebody's mum's, you know, just been diagnosed with cancer, then, you know, it's for me to be able to just touch base with them, to know that, you know, I'm empathizing with them, I've got compassion for them. Mm. You know, if they're struggling, that I'm open to being an ear for them. You know, if they're struggling in any way, what can we do to help them? Because nobody ever knows really when it's your turn. You know, yeah. Nobody ever knows when it's your turn, and we should be paying it forward. We should be looking out for each other. You know, and I think for me, that's how I kind of foster relationships and try to foster them to feel valued, that, yeah, this is a workplace. And absolutely, we expect you to come to work and do your job that you pay for. Absolutely, there's, you know, there's the cold face stuff there. Mm. But at the end of the day, so I want you to know that, you know, you're not going to lose your job if something's happening for you and you are struggling at the moment and you need some extra time off, or you need to reduce your hours on a temporary basis, or whatever you need, we will try and accommodate for you, because we actually value you. And now, we don't want to lose you on a permanent basis. We value you. We value your contribution every day that you come to this hospital. You're part of a team. You're part of the wider hospital connection. So, you know, what is it that we can do for you? Mm. So that's what I really like about this role, that I can, you know, I can go, I know things about the staff, and, you know, I'm not share any intimate details about staff, yeah. But I like to know, you know, I like to know if they're having a bit of a hard time or something, that, you know, if they've nobody else to talk to, then they can come to me. I'm not this out, you know, person that's out of reach, yeah. You know, and that they know that, you know, they know that they can be comfortable to come and talk to somebody and say, look, I am struggling and I need help. And we're not judging. You can be vulnerable. We're not judging you. We've got your back in safe space.
Yeah.
Because I've had experiences where I've been in situations where I've not felt psychologically safe in the space I've been in to be able to perhaps say if I'm struggling too. Yeah. And I don't want, because I've experienced it, that doesn't mean say I want anybody else to experience it. And I know people do, but if I can change something, if I can make something different or create that safe space environment, then I want to be able to do that.
How do you look after you, Jackie? Because your job, obviously, your job, I would imagine, is a very busy role doing what you do, and you're passionate about connecting with your staff. So how do you take care of you and your resilience?
Yeah, well, I think I'm probably naturally quite resilient, and I've thought about this a lot, because this is not my strength. Self-care is not my strength. I really have to concentrate and force myself to do a lot of self-care, because I do put everybody else first, and I do forget me, as people like to remind me that, you know, I do a lot of good coaching around what people should do with self-care. I don't particularly role model this particularly well, but I am very mindful of it. So I do need to give myself a lot of self-talk around remembering to look after me and to keep my cup full, because if my cup's full, how can I be, you know, the person I want to be for everybody else, including my family? So I am very mindful and aware of it. So it's took a while, but I've started to meditate, and that's probably only in the last 18 months or so. So, you know, and I'm not an expert at it by any means, but, you know, I do focus on the deep breathing, the, you know, earthing yourself to the, you know, to the land, listening to the nature and things like that. That's really how I do it, with deep breathing. And, you know, and try, when I'm not on call, because I am on call for the hospital a whole week about. So the week that I'm not on call, I really try and do, you know, downtime on the old devices and the emails and the phone calls. I really, you know, try to, you know, think about what am I going to do on the weekend that's with my family. And I think I am the type of person that re-energizes themselves by spending time with people. So it's not for me to run off and to retreat on the weekend that I'm off call as self-care. That's you know, not that that doesn't sound delightful, but it's still, you know, to have some, you know, rainforest retreat somewhere and some pampering done, I just re-energize myself if I can meet a friend for a coffee, you know, catch up with some family. You know, go to the movies, anything that's, you know, just that sort of stuff will re-energize me.
Yeah.
But you know, self talk's good. I do a lot of self talk. I do a lot of podcasts that I never used to do on my travel to and from work. And I do obviously a little meditation sessions that I have to remember. I have to talk myself into remembering to do them. That's the thing with that one. So that's how I really remain resilient, I think. Yeah. And don't get me wrong, I do have my melting moments, but and that's where I do a lot of self talk to myself, and I remember to be grateful. I just think, what am I grateful for? Don't dwell too much in that, limbic part of the brain. Don't be there too long. Don't hash it out, Jackie. Force yourself into that. Force yourself into that frontal cortex. And what are you grateful for? So yeah, that's what I do.
That's a great message. I love that. So thinking about kind of everything you've learned along the way, and I you've learned so much, that's, you know, it just comes across so loud and clear. What would you say to someone who's now just starting off in their career as a nurse? What advice would you give them?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, is that, isn't it? Because I'd certainly say, I'd certainly look to help them to develop their emotional intelligence early on, because I certainly didn't. When I was kind of introduced to self-awareness, all right, so I guess advice for somebody coming into is I think would be to learn the emotional intelligence. Self-awareness is the biggest one for me. I think I became self-aware when somebody kind of said, you know, about self-awareness. And you know, the more I went to read about that, then the more you develop your self-awareness. I thought, and thank goodness I learned it sooner rather than later, so to speak. Somebody gave me that book, Daniel Coleman, Emotional Intelligence, and I read that, and you know, that kind of like just, you know, got your appetite for that. So I'd also be saying, enjoy every minute of your career, because you never know where it's going to take you, and you never know what opportunities are going to come up, and you know, grab them with both hands. Mm-hmm. You know, be adventurous, be courageous, definitely be courageous. And I would probably say to them, but keep that growth mindset, that open mind about stuff. And I would probably say to them, self-care, learn resilience, and learn to keep your resilience pot full. You know, learn about self-care, look after yourself, and to be able to look after others. I think they would be key messages for me, definitely for an early career nurse now. Yeah. Don't leave it till you're burnt out, and don't leave it till you see somebody else burnt out.
No. What would you most like to be remembered for, Jackie?
Oh yes, this is funny, isn't it? When people ask you this, I think, you know, is it that, you know, what would you like to see written on your tombstone? I don't think people would care what I might be remembered for, or you know, it'd be nice to think somebody might remember me when I'm gone, to be honest, let alone what for, and you know that kind of thing. But on a serious note, I think I really would like to be remembered for somebody that was a people leader, that somebody cared. Yes, she balanced the books, but you know, she was there for her staff. You know, that kind of fondness, I think, would be what I would like to be remembered for. But I think, you know, on a bit of more of a humorous note, I brought alpacas to our rural hospital, and it was the first, it was definitely the first in Queensland. I don't know whether it might even be the first in Australia. But, you know, as a therapy animal, and it was definitely on par with country. And I did all my research around whether alpacas were, you know, had any zoology diseases or anything like that. Did they have injections? Were they like dogs type of thing, you know? And they were, interestingly enough, they were very, as much as people think they spit, they don't actually spit like camels. And, you know, they only actually spit at the each other in the paddock if it's the two males that are competing for top dog. So it was interesting that they did that. They were very clean animals, interestingly enough, and very well behaved. And we brought them from a local alpaca farm who does, you know, parties, and people can visit them on the weekend, and you can picnic with an alpaca and all sorts. So they were very well socialized animals, and they just were such a hit with the community of this hospital, because a lot of them are farmers and they have sheep and cows and you name it, that it really resonated with them over a therapy dog, which we'd also had previously. And it was something, you know, fun and different and a first. And I think if, you know, I remember the CEO of our hospital, HHS at the time, we collected these patient-centered care awards, and I went up for our hospital, and he said, come on, this is the alpaca queen. And I thought, oh, that's so funny. So I think on a humorous note, it might be nice to be remembered as you know, the nursing director that brought the alpacas to the hospital type of thing.
That's actually no mean feat, because I remember in a different role trying to do something similar in rehab, but with pets, and it's such a fabulous thing, but it's not the easiest to actually implement from all the infection control and logistics and
I jumped through a few hoops, and I had to do my research, and we, you know, we put a lot of things in place to get them in, I believe. And I've seen things on post where, you know, people have brought their horses and things like that, you know, and to be honest with you, if somebody wanted to see their horse before they die, we'd let them bring the horse to the hospital. We'd bring the patient out to the car park. We would find a way of doing it, because that's what we do. We, you know, we are all about the patients and, you know, and patient care. But yeah, that was a fun thing to do, and it turned out to be fantastic. And they stopped coming through COVID, disappointingly, but you know, hopefully they'll make an appearance again soon.
That's fabulous. That's fabulous. Well, it's been great to chat with you, Jackie, today. And your passion and your enthusiasm and energy for what you do just comes across loud and clear when you're talking. And you are very much a people person, because that comes across too in terms of a people leader. Leader. And there's lots of things I think that anybody listening will relate to, but also take away from what you've shared today. And I, like you, my career kind of didn't take the straight line. I can relate to that dotted jumping around spider's web. But actually, I don't regret any of that, because like you said, it makes you who you are and what you've learned along the way. So it's a fabulous way to experience nursing. So thank you. It's been lovely to talk with you today.
Oh, I hope people enjoy listening. Thank you.
You're welcome.